Aloha, Mr. Hand. You are listening to Inside the Desert Oasis Room, episode number 66. This episode is sponsored by Tandawai Rum. Established in the Philippines in 1854, Tandawai is one of the world's largest rum producers and winner of over 170 international medals in the past four decades, including Brand of the Year in London's World Branding Awards Rum category from 2015 to 2017 and Rum Brand Champion of the World by thespiritsbusiness.com in 2015. As sponsor of the Inside the Desert Oasis Room podcast and the toast to Master Ninja Ray Buen at the legendary Tiki Tea in Los Angeles, California, Tandawai is the perfect companion to celebrate all things tiki. For more information, check out their webpage at tandawaiusa.com or follow them on Facebook or Instagram at tandawaiusa. This podcast is also sponsored by the Royal Hawaiian. Founded in Laguna Beach, California in 1947, the Royal Hawaiian is South Orange County's premier tropical drink and dining destination. Come try their signature cocktail, the Lapu Lapu, a delicious combination of tropical fruit juices with a generous float of dark spirits. Or other island-inspired favorites like ahi tuna poke or the dynamite crab-crusted mahi mahi. Enjoy their delicious brunch or drop in for happy hour from 2:30 to 5:30 p.m. daily for drink specials and more. To make a reservation, visit royalhawaiianlb.com. Today, we sit down for lunch and chat with Johnny Valour. Johnny Valour is a mug maker and ceramicist who has a rather unconventional approach when it comes to tiki mug making. That is, he doesn't sculpt his mugs in the traditional sense, but rather throws each one on a potter's wheel, making each piece a unique, one-of-a-kind piece of handmade art. As always, I hope you enjoy listening to this episode as much as we did recording it for you. If you enjoyed this episode, I'd like to invite you to subscribe to the podcast. It's free, and it will make it easier for you to enjoy future episodes as they're delivered to you automatically. Shares on your social media pages are always appreciated, and if you'd like to support the show, please stop by desertoasisroom.com and click on the donate button. Every donation, no matter the size, helps keep this podcast coming to you every week. Okay, let's get this started. Here's my conversation with Johnny. I hope you enjoy it. So how was your holiday?
It was a good holiday.
Did Santa bring you what you wanted?
Yeah.
Oh, well, that's good.
Lots of good stuff.
Okay.
Some booze tools, you know, just bar tools.
Okay. No, this is just like cocktail bar tools, not for brewing or anything like that.
No, I already have all the brewing stuff.
Okay.
Don't need any more. That was last year's gift.
Oh, was it really?
Yeah.
The brewing stuff, it sounds to me, though, would be more expensive than the cocktail tools,
yeah.
Right?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Because, yeah, there's a lot more specific tools you need for beer brewing.
Right.
Other than, the, you know, like, you can use cocktail tools just for cocktails.
Yeah. The Imbibe magazine was at my house last week.
Oh,
and
cool.
They were shooting the bar for an upcoming issue that I think they're calling The Anatomy of a Tiki Bar. And, you know, I was obviously flattered that they chose me. They got a reference from basically Martin Kate and Jeff Berry.
Nice.
Who both pointed to me. And I thought, oh, cool, that's very flattering that they would choose me. But, you know, when they came to my bar and they started taking photos of everything, and they said, okay, let's put out your bar tools and we want to take pictures of this and that and da-da-da. Of course, all I could hear in my head was all the haters criticizing my setup once it's all published, right? Oh, God, why does he have this? And why does he use that? And blah, 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 blah. But hey, you know what? It's in the magazine.
But you know what? It's everybody has their own thing.
Yeah.
You get used with something or, you know, you... If you... Because also your bar is... Behind the bar is small. So
right.
So you kind of need... That space.
Yeah, they had me turn the bar around and then took pictures of the back of the bar and then had me move the bar out of the way and then took pictures of the back bar itself. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, you know, they asked me to make drinks and all of that. And right. I was like, all right, here we go. For Imbibe Magazine.
Did you make actual drinks or did you make faux drinks for photos?
I did both.
Okay.
Yeah. So we made actual drinks because... they want a drink with a recipe that they're going to feature. And so I made that. And then we also, I made a bunch of faux drinks for, they wanted to do, they call it a hero shot.
Oh, yeah.
Of just a bunch of different drinks, right, in various glassware. And I thought, okay, how am I going to do this? You know, got to make sure the colors are right and all that. Mm-hmm. And so I put everything in tiki mugs.
Perfect.
Perfect, right?
Iced tea to the top. With
Well, it doesn't matter if it's in a tiki mug. No one will see it,
exactly.
Right? So, but yeah, we did make drinks because we were drinking while we were shooting.
Right.
But
I know some of my Instagram shots, like nicely, you know, nice pictures. And also pictures I've used on Etsy. I would fill up the mug with iced tea so it had the color on top.
Ah, see?
But because it's, you know, I'm in the middle of photographing, you know, the ice is just going to melt away.
Right.
And, you know, I'm going to be, like, you know, manipulating it and, you know, just, you know, it just doesn't really become all appetizing.
That's the thing, is that you're basically on a timer.
Right.
You remember the game Perfection?
Yeah.
Where there's a timer before everything pops?
Yeah.
Well, it was like that when we were shooting, because the ice melts and it makes the top of the glass or the mug very, very liquidy.
Right.
And you want it to have a nice, thick, you know, nuggety looking ice on top.
Exactly.
Right?
Yeah.
So it was a little bit challenging in that we had to get the shots like right after, you know. Mm-hmm. So
I actually do have fake ice, but if you use that fake ice in a glass, it sinks to the bottom.
Oh, really?
So you need to, like, fill a glass up completely.
Yeah, so, okay. That would make sense, because they're not liquid.
Right.
Yeah. So, yeah, but that was neat. I mean, the pictures look really excellent. I haven't actually seen them outside of the camera, but the photographer was sharing the pictures with me as he was, you know, going through that process, and they look really great. So, but, you know, the bar's been photographed for all kinds of different things. Hanahu Magazine,
right?
The in-house magazine or in-flight magazine for Hawaiian Airlines, Martin Kate's book, and a few other projects. And, you know, I don't own any of those photos, so I don't have any high-res photos, at least professional ones,
right,
of the room, which is kind of a bummer, you know? So I see all these nice photos, but then after I see them, they go away because they don't get all, you know, none of them all get published, you know? So, how was your holiday? Anything unusual happen this year? You guys go out of town normally, right?
Well, we spent Christmas with my parents the Sunday before Christmas.
Okay.
Well, the Sunday week before Christmas. And then we went out to visit Robin's mother out in Havasu.
Okay.
And we spent Christmas with her.
Okay. Oh, that sounds good.
Yeah,
what's the weather like out there right now?
It's a little chilly, but it was just so nice and relaxing. It's nice to go there, because we actually went out on Christmas Eve, and we had to go to some of the stores. And Christmas Eve shopping in Havasu is like shopping out here on a Wednesday.
You're right. That's awesome. You know what? I also waited until Christmas Eve to start my Christmas shopping.
Yeah.
But I only had to buy maybe a half dozen things because everyone else wanted money. Like, my daughter wanted money, my son wanted money, my nephew, my niece. They all just want money. They're all teenagers, right? They all want money. So it was, okay, I got to buy something for my sisters and my mom and my aunt, and that's really it. And then a few extras just in case someone shows up that we're not expecting to be at the party and I have something to give them, right?
Right.
But, you know, I woke up that morning and I thought, okay, time to start my shopping. It was Christmas Eve, but hey, you know, I knocked it out at Target at like 8 a.m. I was done in maybe 30-40 minutes.
Oh,
and there's nobody there yet at that hour.
Yeah.
So nice and easy. I had a weird, actually, couple weeks this holiday season, and I've told this story to a few people, and I'm dying to share it, so I'm going to share it with you. So,
all right, let's hear it.
I had an old cat that lived to be 22 years old, and
wow.
Yeah, she had cancer, and in her later months, like the months of just before she passed, she was diabetic. So I was giving her insulin shots twice a day, once in the morning and once in the evening. And she was also taking medication and other things that You know, I was joking with Steph, like, this is like an old people's home. We had, like, medicine bottles on the table, and we had a box of syringes, and we had, you know, her insulin, which was refrigerated and all that. And, you know, she eventually passed, and we took it very hard. You know, she was with us for a long time. She was 22 years old. But in her later years, she was no longer using her litter box. And I looked that up. Do you guys have cats?
No.
So I looked that up, and apparently that's a common thing with older cats, that they just don't bother using it anymore. You know, so what she was doing was she would go and find a corner, and she'd drop a pee bomb on the carpet. And the two front rooms of the house were just pee bombed all over, right? But she'd poop on the tile, she'd pee on the carpet. And we'd clean it up, and if I saw the pee or I could smell it, I'd clean it up. But after she passed, I went and I rented a rug doctor from Home Depot, and I cleaned the carpet with that, right? I spent the whole day cleaning those front rooms, and I got them perfect, man. They looked good, they smelled good, they had a nice, you know, feel to them. Like, I got everything out, everything was perfect.
Yeah.
So I said to Steph, let me enjoy clean carpet for a month before you bring home any animals. Please. All right. And she's like, okay. And I said, just promise me that. And she's like, yeah, okay, okay. She's like, we'll start looking after the holidays. Well, we lasted 3 weeks.
Almost a month.
But we brought two cats home. And you know, part of that's my fault, because she came home early one day after she had a case in Riverside. And so she came home and she's like, hey, you know, let's go get lunch. I'm just going to work from home the rest of the day, blah, blah, blah. But after we had lunch, we happened to drive by this shelter. And she fell in love with this little cat, you know. This little cat is actually a feral cat. Yeah. Now, feral doesn't mean wild. It just means that they are not used to humans, right? So she's very jumpy, very scared. At any sound, even if it's a paper bag, she runs and hides, cowers, that whole thing, right? And I fell in love with another cat. The other cat's a month older, so he's a little bit bigger, very rambunctious, right? Commands a room. You know, like, he'll jump on top of anything, he'll jump off of anything, he'll make friends with whoever picks him up. Very outgoing, very fun. Everything's a toy, whether it's your shoe, whether it's the newspaper, whether it's a pillow, whatever it is, remote control for the TV, everything's a toy, right? We couldn't decide which one we were going to get, and we thought, fuck it. We brought them both home.
Oh, nice. Right?
So, for 2 weeks, we kind of had them separated, because the girl, the one that Steph got, the little one, she just got fixed and she had stitches. And plus, she had an upper respiratory infection. She had a cold, basically. Mm-hmm. And so after the first week and a half, we finally, like, tried to get them to start playing together. Oh, my God, man. The big one, his name is Ferris, by the way. I named him Ferris because I knew this kid's going to be getting in trouble a lot, right? He would demolish her when they would play. Like, he would throw his arms around her, and he would bite, and then roll around, you know, and she would just shriek, you know. So I ended up buying a leash on Amazon, and I put a harness on him, and this way I could pull him back when he would jump on her, and okay. I could pull him back, and it just wasn't working. Like, they would just be a tumble of two cats, you know, screaming, you know. And he wasn't fighting, there was no hissing or anything. Mm-hmm. He just plays rough. Okay. And he doesn't know that he's being too rough on her, right? And so after maybe a week of that, you know, Stephanie and I talked about it, and I thought, you know, it's probably better that they don't live together. Maybe we should just take them back, you know? And so the night before, you know, I was already attached to this cat. You know, he'd sleep in my bed, and we'd wake up, like, you know, he'd be snuggling on me. He'd climb on my chest while I was watching TV, all that kind of stuff. And the night before, I was having a real hard time with it. I was thinking about it all night. But I just knew that, you know, I just didn't think that it was going to work out. So the next morning, went down to the vet, or not the vet, I'm sorry, went down to the shelter. And
we surrendered him. And they had they interviewed us, right? You know, they give you an interview about, you know, why do you want to surrender this animal? And we explained everything to them. They said, okay, you know, he's still a kitten. There's time still. He'll get adopted for Christmas, I'm sure. You know, he'll find another home. He's really loving, right? And it broke my heart. Like, when I walked out the door, I broke down. Like, I just started crying. I was bawling. Like, I was crying really, really hard. And I told myself, sometimes the right decision is not the easiest, right? Sometimes the right decision hurts and is very hard.
Yeah.
But, you know, I have to make the right decision, right? So I'm walking to the car and I'm crying and all this, you know, and I'm thinking about him. And then the rest of the day, I try to, like, take it out, you know, remove it from my head. And he's just, you know, like, I just missed him. You know, every once in a while in the afternoon, like, I break out into this, you know, these crying, like, you know, episodes, and I just have to, like, try to get it out of my system. I'll walk outside and I'll pace and try to get it out of my system. I think about him all day. I think about him all night. Mm-hmm. And at night, I'm thinking about him, like, being in his cage and being by himself and wondering what happened. And then the next day, like, I wake up and he's not there, curled up with me like he always is. And I start crying again, you know. And it's still nighttime. I can't sleep. You know, it's like super early. And I wake up Steph, and she's like, you know, what's wrong? Because I'm crying. And I was like, I don't know. I said, I'm so attached to him. I just feel like I need to go get him. And she's like, well, okay. Like, she said okay right away. And I said, well, am I crazy? I mean, like, tell me, like, will they ever get along? I just know that right now, if I were holding him, and Lily, who's the small one, and if Lily was over there on that cat tree, if I let go, I know he would charge her and he would, like, throw her off the cat tree and just demolish her, you know? Can we ever get this to work? And she's like, I don't know. She's like, realistically, I don't think we can. I think that, you know, their personalities are too different. Cats, they don't all get along, you know?
Right.
She's like, but if you want to try, we can try. And I was like, well, look, I want to say that I want to try, but everybody in the house has to commit to this, because if once I bring him home, I'm never taking him back there. You know, it wouldn't be fair to him. It wouldn't be fair to us, right? Or to me. So she's like, all right, well, call them and see if he's still there, because I dropped him off right when they opened, you know?
Right.
So I had to wait a couple hours because it was still nighttime, like I said. And then I called at around 9 o'clock, and they said, yeah, he's still here. And I told her the whole thing, and she was like, let me talk to my supervisor, because I've never gotten a call like this before. And I thought that was kind of odd, you know, that there's people that have been chased back, like an animal that they surrendered. And she came back on the phone. She's like, yeah, you have to readopt him, but he is available. But since he's back in the general population, it's first come, first serve. So I'd suggest you get here a little bit early, just to, like, to beat the crowd. And I said, okay. So brought my son with me, and I showed up 30 minutes early, and we were the first ones there, right? But by the time the doors opened, there was probably like 25, 30 people in line.
Wow.
Yeah, so it was a combination of families, people who had lost pets that they were looking for, people who had to pay citations, you know, on their animals, and people that had to renew their fees, like their dog license fees, things like that, right? It's like the DMV, yeah. Right? So we're at the very front, and I even put a few extra $100 in my pocket in case some kid saw him the day before and wanted to come early to make sure that they get him, right?
Right.
So I was thinking, like, yeah, if some kid's like, oh, yeah, there he is, I'd be like, hey, kid, what do you want for Christmas? You want that new Xbox? Pull out some money. Yeah, here you go, kid. Just pick another cat. Like the mob, right? And I told Christian, you know, okay, this is how it works. When we get to the cat building, because they have separate buildings for cats and dogs and all these other animals, bunnies and things like that, reptiles. And And so when we get to the cab building, there's pens on the left side and pens on the right. And we're going to split up, and the first person who finds him is going to pull the kennel card. That way there's no information on the cat. And we booked it over there as soon as they opened the doors, right? We booked it to that building. I found him. I pulled the kennel card. And there were families right behind us. There was probably like three or four families right behind us. They're picking out animals for Christmas.
Oh, yeah.
Right? And so the people that manage the kennels, they weren't, you know, out on the floor yet because, you know, they don't expect people to, you know, right away, as soon as the doors open, say, I want to adopt this cat. So I was, like, looking for people. I couldn't find anybody. I just walked through the sign that said employees only. Mm-hmm. And I'm waving the kennel card. I'm like, hello, hello, hello. Girl comes out and she's like, yes. And I said, yeah, I want to adopt this cat. And she said, okay, but we like for you to socialize with them first before you take them home so that you know for sure that you like the cat. And I said, well, yeah, I know this cat. I surrendered this cat yesterday. It's lived with me for 2 weeks, and I want it back. He needs to be back home. And so she said, oh, yeah, we were talking about that this morning because I called, right?
Right.
So she's like, all right, let me talk to my supervisor and see if we can reverse the surrender so you don't have to repay the adoption fees. And it was like that everywhere, you know, and nobody could do anything. I said, I don't care. I'll pay the fees, whatever. You know, I brought extra money, right, yeah. Just because I had to bribe a kid. So go to the window, and the guy says, you know, he pulls up the cat ID, and he's like, oh, you're the one that surrendered this guy. Like, everybody knew who the cat was and who I was.
Yeah.
And I said, yeah, I said, you know, I just want to take him home, you know. And he goes, okay, well, you need to be interviewed before you readopt this cat. So I was like, damn, you know, it's like, so they interviewed me again.
Can we turn this interview into a podcast?
Right. I never thought of that. Well, like, made it through the interview, right? And the guy was like, let me see if I can hook you up with the fees. And the guy just looks at me and says, give me $20 and you can take your animal home.
Nice.
And I was like, awesome, dude. So I gave him $20. I stuck my hand through the glass and I shook his hand. And he was surprised by that. But he was like, Merry Christmas, man. And so it was a happy ending. I took him home. And I was crying on the way home because I got my Ferris back. And Christian was like, man, this is like out of a movie. He's like, yeah. It's like the scene when you run to, you know, when you're running through the airport trying to save somebody from leaving. And then he's like, we should get some Save Ferris shirts before we drive out there. So that was my interesting couple weeks. And now he's at home. And we're still dealing with, you know, I still have him in a harness, mm-hmm. and I'm still like regulating when they play, but he's being gentler, you know.
Okay.
And Lily's grown up a little bit, but you know, it's amazing how much they've gotten bigger in the weeks that they've been with us. It's been less than a month,
yeah.
You know. But you know, one day she'll be the same size as him, and hopefully within the next year I'll be able to have them together without them being so rough and tumble,
right?
You know, but she needs to learn that, you know, that she can, you know, because Stephanie, man, you know, like whenever this cat starts playing and he starts getting rough on her, she pushes Ferris back and she takes Lily and covers her in her arms. I'm like, you can't fight for her, right?
Yeah.
Because then she's never gonna learn to defend herself. You just gotta let her get beat up and, you know, let her turn on him one day, and then he'll learn that, like, okay, she doesn't like that,
right?
You know, so that was my my interesting holiday, and it was a long story. Thanks for listening to that.
Oh, sure.
And also all our listeners out there, thanks for listening to that. But that was our Christmas gift to each other.
No, seriously, yeah. That was like a movie.
It was like a movie.
Yeah.
It's so like a movie. Oh my God, man. I can't believe how attached I get to these animals, you know. He was only at the house for 2 weeks.
You know, I have fish, and mm-hmm. I get attached to them.
Really?
Yeah.
This episode is sponsored by Tiki Diablo, artist, carver, builder, and mug maker. Tiki Diablo makes artistically sculpted high-end mugs, bowls, and other art pieces for bars, restaurants, distilleries, and spirits companies. He also builds and installs one-of-a-kind themed environments in both residential and commercial spaces. To see his art, Tiki's mugs, or buildouts, go to TikiDiablo.com or find him on Facebook or Instagram at Tiki Diablo.
Actually, right now, one of my fish, I don't know if it's male or female. I think she's probably a female. I refer to her as a female.
What's her name? Do you have you named her?
Yeah, it's Foxy.
Foxy.
Because she's a yellow fish with a black nose, so she kind of looks like a fox.
Oh, and I thought she had like a sexy swim or something. Maybe.
And well, it's she. She's referred to as a fox face low.
Oh, okay. So that's also part of her breed.
Yeah.
Okay.
So she had been kind of acting kind of weird. This was like many weeks ago. And she was swimming and she was bumping into stuff, like, you know, in bumping into the glass, bumping into some of the decorations. And it kind of occurred to me that I think she might have gone blind.
Oh, wow.
Because she is an old fish. And she would just kind of hover, you know, in not in her normal spot where she would be.
How old was she?
Oh, I don't know. She's like many years old. I don't know.
Wow, that's pretty cool. There was a time when I got into keeping fish, mm-hmm. but I've never had fish that have lasted that long.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know if it's me. I like to think that it wasn't because I was very meticulous about how I kept the tanks, mm-hmm. you know, checking pH and making sure that everything was clean, you know, right. I'd gravel back everything, clean yeah. filters, and I'd try not to mess up the bacteria or anything like that.
Yep, and I do all that stuff too.
Yeah.
But, you know, I think just age, she just may have gone blind, but, you know, and I thought I was going to lose her really quickly, you know, because I didn't know how she would feed, but she had been hanging in, and I didn't know, like, how she was surviving.
Yeah.
Because I would still feed the fish, and...
She wouldn't eat it.
I wouldn't see her eat it.
Okay.
She would just be just kind of hovering between, like, a decoration and the glass.
Yeah.
Because, I had done some tests. Like, I would, like, flash a light at her because she's kind of skittish.
Okay.
She's always been kind of skittish. So I'd, like, do a flashlight on her, and she would never move.
Yeah.
So this is kind of why I think she can't see anymore.
Right.
And, but I would still feed, and she wouldn't move when I would feed her. But... One day Robin saw her just kind of swimming along the bottom and just kind of pecking along the bottom. So she was obviously getting stuff that, like, food from the bottom.
Right, right.
And now I've noticed she kind of does this thing where she comes up to the surface of the water, like, just random times, and she'll just kind of start gulping around, even if I haven't fed her or anything.
That's interesting.
Like, every once in a while she'll just be up there doing that.
Is she looking for food?
Yeah.
Okay.
But she doesn't look any thinner, or she doesn't look sickly. She just still looks like her normal self.
Yeah.
Yeah, and the thing is, like, I can't go in there and force feed her, because on her dorsal fin, she has kind of, like, spiny dorsal fin, and they're poisonous. They're toxic. So if it stings me...
Is she a saltwater fish?
Yes.
Okay.
It would irritate me.
Yeah. Do you have any other fish in that tank?
Yeah, I have a clownfish.
Okay. And they're not behaving any different then?
No.
Well, clownfish are pretty hardy.
Yeah. And then I have a damsel in there that's been in there as long as Foxy's been in there.
A blue or a black?
Blue with a yellowtail.
Yeah.
And then I have a Christmas wrasse.
Yeah.
She's mostly green, and then, like, this metallic red stripes on her. And then kind of like a bluish tail. It's just a really good-looking wrasse.
So she's still around. She hasn't died yet.
No.
Are you going to do anything when she passes? Like, when my cat passed, Allie, the 22-year-old cat, mm-hmm. we had her cremated, and we put her in a box. And I know this is a fish, but, you know, like, it's still a pet, and you get attached to them.
Yeah.
You know, when I was a kid, there was this goldfish that I kept. It was a feeder fish, and he was just one of the prettier feeder fish that I didn't want to see get eaten.
Right.
So I separated him, and he lived for quite a while. And when he died, we actually, like, you know, put him in a box and we buried him in the backyard. You know.
Yeah, I don't really have a place to bury her. I could probably put her into a pot in the balcony.
So I know it sounds silly, but again, they're pets, you know. And
well, also one of my favorite fish was a little puffer fish I had. He was a yellow puffer with black spots on the top. He was actually considered brackish, so he could live. He where he lived was he lived like in the ocean, but at the edges of rivers.
They're the little ones, right?
Yeah.
They're real small. Mm-hmm. I had some of those too.
But he grew to be maybe about 4 inches.
Oh, that's pretty big.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, they get about that big.
Mine never lasted that long, yeah. You know, because they're brackish, and I never really maintained a brackish tank. Mm-hmm. Was it brackish?
No, because you can bring them from brackish to all salt.
I brought them to fresh.
Yeah.
Because, you know, it could go either direction depending on, right. You know. But I think I had a couple of those. They died. There was a time when I had a bunch of tanks in that, you know, like I had like a 100-gallon fresh that just had Oscars in it.
Oh, yeah.
They were small. They were only about an inch long when I put them in there. And by the time that I had to get rid of them, they were probably, I don't know, 10 inches.
Wow, that's really good.
Because, you know, they grow really fast, yeah. And they outgrew the tank. Mm-hmm. There's two of them. They started fighting, and, you know, they were just territorial. But they were beautiful. They had nice colors on them.
How big was your tank?
It was 100-gallon.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and then I had a 60-gallon specifically just for an arowana that committed suicide one summer. That jumped out of it.
I thought those were illegal.
No, you could buy them. No, I bought it at an aquarium store at the time. And I have had salt before. I've never been able to really successfully keep a salt tank.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's easier when the tank is bigger, right? Because it buffers out your mistakes.
Right.
And I never had a huge one. They were all smaller.
Mm-hmm.
And so you have to be very precise because the amount of water, the volume is much smaller. So you have to really be strict with the maintenance.
Right.
I had live rock in there, and I had mandarin gobies, and I had anemones and clownfish.
Yeah, mandarins are really difficult to keep.
Yeah, the mandarin died pretty early on.
Yeah.
The clownfish and the damsels. The damsels are like the goldfish of the salt water world, and that lasted a while. And when everything else died in that tank, I took that, it was a blue damsel with a yellow tail,
mm-hmm.
and I thought, okay, well, I'm going to take the saltwater tank down. I took a net and I fished that damsel out, and I dropped it in my Oscar tank, mm-hmm. just to feed the Oscars with it. The Oscar, you know, swallowed it and then spit it right back out.
Oh.
Just because, you know, what is this, right? It's a saltwater fish. And that damsel lived in that freshwater tank for probably 4 or 5 days.
Wow.
Yeah, before finally it went. And the Oscars never touched it, you know?
Yeah.
And so maybe that was a cool thing to do in retrospect. But, you know, that was a test fish. Like, where I would get my fish from, they would use that as a test fish to test the waters.
Right.
They said, like, you know, throw one of those in there, and it also helps with the bacteria, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
So they were considered kind of like gutter fish, you know? They're, like, like I said, the goldfish of the saltwater world.
They are, like, those blue with the yellow tail. They're a good-looking fish.
Yeah.
But you can only keep one of them because they're very aggressive.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah. Like, they'll be aggressive to other damsels of their type. But, like, all damsels are very aggressive.
Okay. I didn't know that. So we had also a cichlid tank. African cichlids. Mm-hmm. They're freshwater. And they're really colorful. They're probably one of the more colorful freshwater fish. They get pretty big, too.
Yeah.
And they get really aggressive.
Right.
Those they're, man, like...
Yeah, they're very territorial.
Hugely territorial. And, you know, like, every time one would snap at the other, I'd tap the tank, like, hey, stop it! like I could train it, right? But I had to give those away, too, because they outgrew the tank, you know? And, you know, the thing about aquariums is... It's a fun hobby if you're really into it, but once you fall out of really the interest of keeping the tanks, they become very, very tedious.
Yeah,
you know.
I've been keeping tanks ever since I was a kid.
Yeah,
and I really enjoy it.
Do you have any other ones other than this one?
Robin actually has a 10-gallon freshwater.
Okay.
That she has platies in.
Okay.
And the platies gave birth.
Had babies, yeah.
So now she's got like 9 platies in this little tank.
I had platies also that gave birth. I had gouramis that gave birth.
Oh, wow.
And the babies didn't survive. Some got eaten.
Yeah.
And the rest, I don't know what happened, but you know, I don't know if they got eaten or whatever, but they just didn't survive, mm-hmm. you know. So, but if they're having babies, that means that you guys are doing something right because they're comfortable yeah. enough to mate.
I've actually had some pajama cardinals in my saltwater tank. And these fish, they got like a big eye. They're kind of triangular shaped. Their front is kind of like a little bit of red on the face, but mostly kind of tan color. And then on the back part, there's black spots.
Okay.
They look like pajamas.
Okay.
They look like they're wearing pajamas.
Is that a fresh or salt?
It's salt.
Salt, okay.
And I noticed one of my cardinals was never coming out to eat. Because I had two of them in there. One of them would never come out to eat. He was always hiding in the back, but he didn't look sick or anything. So I saw one time he just kind of raised up from behind all the decoration, and I could see in his mouth, there was something weird about his mouth. So I got into a closer look, and they were eggs. So I went online and I checked it out. And so what happens is the male will hold the eggs in its mouth.
Interesting.
Until they hatch. Now, I couldn't, there was like no way for me to net him and put him into a birthing
right,
tank
right.
or whatever. Because I would never be able to get the net behind, and
right.
I didn't really want to.
And you don't want to disturb it. Yeah.
Right. So I just couldn't let, I couldn't have them, you know, I couldn't have the babies.
Yeah. Oh.
Yeah.
Wow.
But that was something I was not expecting to happen.
Wow. That's pretty crazy.
Yeah. Plus, it's really difficult to raise saltwater, like the fry, the small
yeah, yeah,
fish,
yeah, yeah.
like baby fish.
Are you familiar with freshwater discus?
Kinda.
So, they apparently are very sensitive too. The water requirements are really strict, right? They have to be something like 84 degrees, and they have to be soft water, right? Like you have to be really strict with the pH and all that kind of stuff too.
Mm-hmm.
So I know that I would kill those if I had them because I I've never had success raising or keeping sensitive fish like that, right? They have sensitive
yeah.
environments. But they're beautiful to look at when you see them at an aquarium store because they group, right? They school.
Yeah.
And when you touch the tanks, they're warm
right.
because the water has to be warm. So, but where are they from? I think they're from Africa.
Yeah, they're actually, I think they are a cichlid.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. That would make sense. That would explain why they have those colors. But yeah, some of them have these fluorescent, iridescent colors that if you put a black light on top of the water, they really shine through.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, yeah. So, yeah, it's been a while since I took care of fish, and I recently went looking because I thought, oh, maybe I'll try to do another tank, and knowing that I wasn't really going to. But I was shocked at how much fish cost nowadays.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, like, oh my God. You know when
it is a commitment.
It's a commitment. You know when Christian was little, I had these fish that were cichlids, and I had five of them, and they were this neat silver navy blue color,
oh,
right?
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
And it was a 60-gallon acrylic tank that was in my house. That was like a big piece of decor. So really beautiful. One time I was, you know, I was feeding him, and I saw one of them was swimming listfully, you know. And he'd been swimming that way for maybe 2 days. And I said to my wife at the time, I was with my first wife at the time, I said, you know what, I don't think this guy's going to make it. He's probably going to die. And she's like, oh, that's too bad. And these cichlids I bought, I didn't buy them at an aquarium store. I actually bought them at Walmart. And the reason why I bought them was because when I was walking by the tank, I'd never seen that color of those cichlids before because you see the typical oranges and reds and that kind of thing, but
right.
these were silver with the blue, like blue bellies or something.
Yeah.
And I thought, wow. So never saw them anywhere before. And that's part of the story because she and I went out of town And I was gone for maybe 4 or 5 days, and I asked my sister to house sit for me, right? Take in the mail and all that kind of stuff, pick up the newspaper and feed the fish. And, you know, I'd call her and she'd say, oh, yeah, everything's fine, everything, you know, no problems. And when I got home, there was a brand new fish. Like, the one that was swimming listfully was gone and had been replaced, right, by a fish that looked just like it. And I was like, I said, hey, I think I got a new fish. So I tell my wife, like, come over here, look at this. And she's like, yeah, that's a new fish. Because, you know what your fish look like, right? She's like, that's a new fish. I'm like, yeah, look, I know that he didn't become bionic while we were gone. Like, you know, so my sister apparently told my other sister, oh, my God, I killed this fish because it died while we were out of town. And apparently she spent the rest of the week looking for that fish, right, that replacement.
Oh, that's so funny.
And I didn't say anything to her until, like, a year later or 2 years later. She brought it up. She goes, oh, yeah. You know what? She's like, she was like being smart with me. She's like, yeah, I pulled one off on you because, like, I killed one of your fish, but I replaced it before you knew it. And I was like, yeah, well, you think you got the last laugh? I got the last laugh because I knew you replaced it because that fish was going to die. So I knew it was going to die. But, oh, well. That's hilarious. But so I don't know how this became an Animal Talk podcast, but...
we're talking pets.
Talking pets. So let's take a quick break, and then when we come back, I want to talk to you about your pottery.
Sure. Let's get another drink.
All right. Awesome.
This episode is brought to you in part by Steadfast Pomade. Steadfast Pomade is a strong-holding, medium-bodied, water-based styling product for men and women, which leaves your hair looking slick, neat, and shiny with a clean, fresh scent. Its unique formula allows you to easily restyle your hair throughout the day and washes out with ease. Steadfast Pomade is American-made and veteran-owned. Available in original and anchor hold. Get yours today at steadfastpomade.com. Tame the waves and keep it steadfast. This episode is also sponsored by the Tiki Tea. Founded in 1961, the Tiki Tea is a family-owned and operated tropical drink bar practicing the lost art of exotic cocktail mixing. Come try their house specialty, the Ray's Mistake, a delicious concoction of botanic liqueurs, passion fruit, gin, and rum for only $6 on Wednesdays until 9 p.m. The Tiki Tea is located at 4427 Sunset Boulevard in Hollywood, California. For more information, check out their website, tiki-ti.com. The Tiki Tea, Ground Zero for tropical drinks.
And we are back.
Fresh drinks in hand.
With new drinks in hand. I want to talk about your ceramics because I know that something that you're doing now that is new is this multicolor glaze that I saw on, I think I saw it on a bowl and some of the smaller cups.
I haven't put it on a bowl, but I do it on cups and bottles.
Oh, God, cups and bottles. Okay.
Yeah. I haven't put it on any bowls yet.
Now, you're painting those freehand, right?
Yeah, it's all freehand.
You don't use a stencil or anything for that?
Nope.
So, I'm curious about how these colors come out, because when you paint those, it's obviously it's not going to look the way that it looks after it's fired.
Actually, with these glazes that I'm using, they're underglaze, and they're really meant for more of a low fire.
Okay.
And I fire at a high fire. These glazes are meant for a like cone 5, but I fired at a cone 10. But luckily, these underglazes that I use, they retain their color at this high temperature. Not all of them do.
Okay, so well then that begs the question: why would you fire them at a higher? Like a cone 10 instead of cone 5 if they're designed for cone 5.
Because I pretty much work with clay that's cone 10.
Oh, it's the clay.
Yeah.
Okay.
I could use a cone 5, but I just if I decide to do something else with a different glaze, I use cone 10 glazes.
Okay. Okay. So I know that the tiki world or the people that collect tiki mugs and collect your art, I know that a lot of them are familiar with your process and that, you know, you're not the kind of mug maker that makes molds.
No, I don't do any molds.
Yeah, every piece is one of a kind, all hand-thrown.
Yep.
And I think I only know one other ceramicist that does that in the tiki world, which is Mike Sabica.
Yeah.
Right?
That's correct.
Have you guys done any work together?
We didn't really do any work, but we did go to... we did a workshop out in Las Vegas together. And we did a lot of throwing out there. And there was actually a piece that... There were some pieces that other people did that they couldn't travel back with, because a lot of the other people who took the workshop flew out from South Carolina.
Oh, okay.
You know, yeah. They came from Utah, Portland, and we all just did this workshop. So on the last day, a bunch of people threw some pieces. So they gave me some pieces, they gave Sabika some pieces, and then we each glazed them.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah.
Wow, what kind of pieces were they? Were
actually, yeah, there was one piece that somebody threw the shape. And then I think Sabika did some slip work on it, and then I did the glazing.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. So, yeah, we kind of just all did that was a collaboration right there.
So when you say threw the shape, so they are all round pieces then? They're
yes.
like bowls or...
Yeah, all wheel thrown, yeah.
Yeah.
So they're, you know, all start with cylinders.
Have you ever tried clay sculpting?
You know, I did that when I was a kid, and I liked it, but I didn't really like it.
You didn't really, like, gravitate towards it?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, because, you know, it's just so different from the way that you guys make your mugs.
Yeah.
You know? You know, even some of Mike's stuff, you can't really see that it's a thrown piece.
Well, he does a lot of thrown pieces, but he also does a lot of molds too. But he also
does
those molds. But he does those mold pieces at the cone 10 level. So they are going to be way different than anything else.
Now, do you know how to make molds?
Yeah.
Oh, you do.
Yeah.
Have you made any for any of your stuff before?
I haven't. I've never made anything for my stuff. But I know the process. I've made molds for. I've poured like latex molds.
Okay.
And I've also done molds that would be also like more plaster pieces. Like I did this all in art school.
Oh, okay. Yeah. I've been told that mold making is an art in itself.
It is, yeah.
That it's, you know, there's people that all they do is make molds.
Right, yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So there are artists that will have a piece that will take it to a guy that all he does is make molds for whoever brings him something to make a mold of.
Yep. Because with Tiki mugs, you can get really elaborate with how many pieces this mold can be.
Right.
There's actually somebody I follow on Instagram where he does these multicolored vases and bottles and cups, and it would kind of look like a just triangles of color just coming from a center and going around, and each color is a piece of mold.
Wow.
So it's basically he's like laying a brickwork of molds to create a bottle, and then what he does is he paints the mold, and then he pours in more slip, and then it all just sticks. It's just it's so incredible.
And to add to the complexity of what you just said, I know that when some of these tiki mug makers make their first molds, they actually mold the mold itself with silicone, right? So that they have a master that they can make more molds from. Does that make sense?
Oh, yeah. I don't know the process about that, but I'm sure that's...
But you know what I'm saying, right?
Yeah.
So I know actually three off the top of my head, I know that that's one of the things that they do so that they can make multiple molds, and it just makes it easier for them to make the number of mugs that they have to produce.
Right.
And so this is how you get the exact same mold, right? You make a silicone mold of the first mold, and then you make subsequent molds from that silicone mold. That's the master. So having said that, if this person made silicone molds of each of those molds, right? Because if you're doing like a multiple piece mold and you're doing that process, you're gonna have all of these other extra steps that you got to do.
I don't know his process on how he does everything, but it doesn't even matter, because what you want is his final product. It's just incredible.
You know, and it's a reminder of how intricate and how much labor there is involved in creating these things that we like to collect, because, you know, when we show up to an event, it's just there. And
yeah,
people sometimes just don't appreciate like what it took to get there on that table.
Right.
Right. I know that there are some mugs, like, for example, Notch made this mug that came out of a 17-piece mold. And he said to me when I was buying that mug, he said, this mug came out of a 17-piece mold. 17 pieces. And I thought, yeah, that's a jigsaw puzzle.
Right.
Right?
Yeah.
And those pieces all start to wear out once you start using that mold. Mm-hmm. So if you want to get a high run out of it, you got to make silicon masters of all that.
Right.
Which is that extra... you know, extra steps. So it's a crazy thought, you know?
I know. Like, where I work is I don't really have the room to have molds anyway.
Okay.
And I can throw pieces and glaze pieces as fast as I would be.
Molding it.
Yeah.
Yeah. But that's not really the practice there anyway, if people are throwing pieces, right?
Right.
People aren't really molding it. Are they doing what you're doing when you're using different colored slips? And I think it's different slip that you, or is it clay that you're using different colors?
Yeah, I can use different kinds of clay. Like, I use a porcelain, which is the very bright white pieces that I use that I would paint the underglaze on. Then there's a really gritty, sandy, like brownish color clay that I use, and then there's also like a black clay that I use.
Well, I've seen some of your Tiki Bob style mugs that you've used different colors on.
Oh, the marble technique, yeah.
Okay.
So I would take those different color clays, and then I would just kind of like roll them together and knead them together so they kind of start to mix in with each other. And then when I put it on the wheel and I pull it up, it looks like marble almost.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, does that ever... Because when you say that they're all different colors, I mean, is the texture the same? So when you pull it, do they all pull evenly?
No, actually.
Yeah, see, that's my thought.
Porcelain is a little more dense, so that kind of tends to be a little more rough as I'm pulling it, so
right.
I really have to be very steady when I'm pulling it up.
Right.
The sandier clays are softer, so they'll tend to stretch a little quicker than the porcelain does.
So what do you have on your plate for the future? What's some of the new stuff that you are thinking about trying?
I'm going to be making larger things.
Okay.
Probably some larger bowls, more vases, probably platters also that I'm going.
Oh, platters!
Yeah, I've made a platter a while back where I've carved like a fish scene on it.
Uh huh.
And that came out really nice.
Okay.
You know, I would, and with these platters, I would make it so you'd be able to hang them up on the wall.
Okay.
So it'd be more wall art that you could use if you wanted to serve with them.
Oh, that'd be cool. So I have a question for you that's really kind of more of a riddle. Because I was talking about this with someone recently, and we're trying to figure out how they did this. The vintage Chinese jade tiles.
Okay.
Now, I've never seen a Chinese jade tile that has a foot on it. It's glazed all the way around.
Okay, yeah.
How do they do that?
You can place it in the kiln on what's known as like a little... It's a little seat that has metal pegs coming out of it.
Uh-huh.
So basically you're putting them on top of like... what's kind of like a nail almost.
Right.
So there, you would, if you looked closely, you would be able to
see a pin,
a little pin,
like a pinhole.
Yeah,
where the glaze.
You gotta look really closely. Yeah.
Right, and it uses probably a different kind of kiln that you and I are used to, right? Because it wouldn't fit into a round kiln. It'd be more like an oven.
You could
right?
put it in a round kiln.
Well, I suppose that for production purposes is what I'm thinking. You know.
Well, for large production, they would just have a really large kiln that would be a square
Right. Where you could line them all up.
Yeah.
Because I always picture these round kilns that there are mug makers that we all know because they put cylinders in them, right? Like they're mugs and bowls.
Yeah.
So,
yeah, but if you did put one of those big tiles into the round kiln, then you just have empty space and they could fill that with other pieces of pottery.
Now, I have other questions about glazing that I've been told you can glaze and fire and reglaze and fire and reglaze and fire a mug.
Yes.
You can?
Yes.
And that will obviously change the way that it looks every single time.
Correct, yeah.
Right. So, if I had a mug that I wanted to be unique, let's just say like I have one of the mugs that, I just had made for the podcast, but I want to have it be different than everybody else's. Mm-hmm. Could I reglaze that and refire that?
Yes, you can. But make sure that you know what temperature it was fired at.
Okay.
Because if you take that mug, which was probably a low fire, and put it into a high fire, you're going to melt the mug.
Oh.
The mug will turn into a puddle.
Have you ever had that happen to you?
Not to me, but I've seen it happen.
Oh, really?
Yes. I've seen the kiln open, and there is just a blob that's flown onto other people's pottery and over the edge of the kiln.
Oh, no!
Yeah.
And then it's a big mess to clean up.
Yeah, well, you basically can't clean it up. You have, if it's melted on the shelf, you just got to throw away the shelf.
Wow! And then in the kiln itself, too, right? Because if it bleeds all across...
Yeah, if it gets into the brick, you got to replace that or just, like, chisel it out.
Wow!
Yeah.
What a pain in the ass.
It is a pain
in
the ass.
If I were running a studio and somebody did that, I'd be like, all right, who did this? They're paying for it.
Oh, yeah. That's exactly what happens.
Wow. Okay. What about, what does your loss look like when it comes to production? What's your success rate?
I have a high success rate. I usually throw away about maybe like 10% of my stuff.
Oh, that's not bad at all. That's pretty good, right?
Yeah.
What do you think the average is?
It's probably about that, yeah.
About 10%,
yeah.
Because sometimes I'll see these videos and pictures of people taking mugs and they're breaking them over a trash bin, mm-hmm. right? And they're saying like, oh, the glaze came out wrong or something came out wrong. It's heartbreaking to see.
Yeah.
You know, not only to see those particular mugs get broken because you think that everything looks great, like, you know, that looks fine to me, why would you break that?
Right, well,
but just the loss of time and the loss of materials.
Yeah, and it's, you know, that's something that you have to be okay with. It's
right.
Like you just...
That's part of the process.
Yeah, it's like, yeah, it's part of the process. You know, you're always going to be disappointed with something. Something is always going to run. Something's always going to break. And you have to be okay with it. You can expect the best. You can put all the time you want into it just to make it perfect and then have it come out broken.
It's like brewing beer.
Yeah, exactly.
You don't know until after it's done, right? Because the thing about working with a kiln is you can't just check on it, you know, like a brownies, right?
Exactly, yeah.
You have to wait.
Yep.
And you just don't know what you're going to open up.
Exactly.
You know?
Yeah.
So
it's like Christmas every day.
Every day. Oh, that's interesting. Man, so that requires some real patience.
Right. It does.
Have you had any projects that you were really looking forward to seeing just get ruined?
Oh, yeah. The one thing that I have break the most are plates.
Okay.
Only because because it is such a wide surface. And so, like, when it shrinks, if I let it dry out too fast, it could crack, it could warp, and then putting it into the kiln, like if it didn't look cracked when I glazed it, it could crack in the kiln.
Okay. So I know that this is not what you do for your day job, and this is more of a hobby. Have you ever thought about, I'm sure you have thought about doing this as a full-time thing.
Oh, yeah.
Right? Is that more of like a living the dream kind of thing right now, or is that a bucket list item for later on in life?
That's going to be for later in life.
Yeah.
Yeah, when I'm able to have like all the time to devote to it, because it is a lot of work.
Yeah.
It's work all the time.
I've said before that I've tried my hand at doing mugs more than once, and I've sculpted a few things, and I just didn't like the way that it looked, so I've crumpled it back down.
Yeah.
And you know, I know the whole manufacturing process. It's a lot of steps.
Yeah.
And something can go wrong anywhere in that process, right?
Yeah.
From the sculpt to the drying to the firing to the glazing to the whatever, mm-hmm. right? And then in the end, everything would come out perfect, and then you could just, you know, have some Butterfingers and drop it.
Right? I've done that.
Oh, you have. And, you know, I'm just advocating for you guys that knowing how much work each step has, and that, you know, this thing, like this finished product, doesn't happen overnight.
Right.
It's amazing to me how little some of these things sell for, because I think, wow, so after all that, I'm only going to sell it for $75, you know?
Right.
It's like after days and days and days and hours and hours and hours of work.
Right. And you also got to make up for your losses.
Right. And you got to make up for your losses. And then all your overhead, like when your electricity just gets, you know, shoots through the roof, because then you're firing at 220, right?
Right.
That's the electricity you're mm-hmm. using. And I think, wow, so $75, I think I'd rather just pay the $75 and get it. And I know that it sounds expensive, you know, from our side, because it's just really a glass, a cup.
Right.
You know, drinking vessel, right?
But it's also a work of art.
It is. Yeah, you have to look at it that way.
That you can drink out of and yeah. enjoy all the time.
Yeah. Do you have any influences with the style that you do? Or is there anybody in your studio or anybody in the art world that maybe that you pull inspiration or ideas
yeah,
from?
You know, I was talking about that workshop that I went to in Vegas. There was a particular shape of cup that a lot of people were throwing, and it's a more traditional Japanese teacup.
Oh, okay.
And so it has a very narrow foot, and then it will flare out to an edge and then curve back in and back out. And I thought that was such an interesting shape that I've kind of adopted that to using in some of my pieces.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, it holds very nicely.
Okay.
And I've made small ones, but I'm actually making large ones, kind of more of like a vase size.
Okay.
And they yeah, it's a nice shape to look at too.
Okay, cool. So new projects with that style coming out, new projects with the glaze that you are now painting on as a mosaic,
yeah.
right? And larger pieces. These are all things that we are
that's what I'm going to be working on. Yeah,
very cool. So one more time, where can everybody see your work if they want to check you out?
I'm mostly on Instagram. It's Johnny Velour, which is JohnnieVelour.
Okay,
it's with an IE.
At Johnny Velour, with an IE, and website.
Same thing.
JohnnieVelour.com. Awesome.
And then also from there, they can find my Instagram. And there's nothing on my Etsy page right now, but I'm hoping at the beginning of the year to put more stuff up on there.
Cool. Johnny Velour on Etsy also.
Yes.
Awesome.
Johnny Velour everywhere.
Everywhere. Should we talk about how you got that name?
Oh, yeah, we totally can.
Because I know the story.
Yeah, we can totally talk about that.
So let's tell our listeners how Johnny Velour came to be.
Yeah, it's a fun story. I was, me and my roommate and a few other people, we were going to go down to San Diego for New Year's. And so my roommate got the bright idea, hey, we got to come up with aliases.
So right.
So I'm all, okay, I'm going to be Johnny Z, right?
And no, why Z? It just came up.
Yeah. Well, I think whenever I was doing video games and I put my name in, I would do just Johnny Z.
Oh, okay, yeah.
So I'm all, yeah, I'll just be Johnny Z. And he's all, no, I'll come up with something.
Okay.
So
there was a Jimmy Z.
Oh, really?
You remember the surf clothing?
Yeah.
But it was, right. And I learned later that it was never pronounced Jimmy Z. It was pronounced Jimmy's. They just used a Z instead of an S. And it was an apostrophe, right? Like Jimmy's.
Oh.
It was possessive.
How progressive.
So Maybe Johnny's, right? Johnny, Johnny Z. Okay, so anyway, he wanted to come up with a name.
Right. So, and he wanted, for some reason, he came up, like, he wanted to be, like, animal something.
Okay.
So, I was, like, in the bathroom, and I come out, and I go, I got the name for you, Animal Jones.
That sounds like a wrestler.
Right? So and then later he just came up, oh, yeah, you're going to be Johnny Velour.
Uh-huh.
And I'm all, right on.
All right. And he didn't tell you where he got that?
No, he just happened to come up with it.
Yeah.
So the best thing was, so before we went down to San Diego, we had gone to Goodwill, and we were going to get, like, some jackets, you know, right. Some nice suit jackets. And he found one that was... it was for the Anheuser-Busch theme parks.
Well, so, yeah, I remember that.
Yeah, it was a yellow jacket. It had red trim on it. And on the inside, it had, like, this white and pink candy cane satin. And it was amazing. Oh, and then it had an A on the front for the Anheuser-Busch. But he said, this is for Animal Jones.
You could always rename it.
Exactly. And then I found myself a nice velour blue jacket.
Nice. And there it is.
And that, yep.
There it is, Johnny Velour. That's awesome. It is a pretty cool name, though.
So, well, then I started using it just online as a name because I just liked the name, and then it just kind of stuck.
Yeah. You should have been using that on your Facebook before they started.
I tried
clamping down.
They had it already.
Oh,
clamped down.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah, Facebook police, man, they can be brutal.
Yeah.
Cool. Well, I appreciate you meeting me for lunch, and I appreciate you sharing some of this information on the process that you do with your ceramics, because I know that for a lot of artists, especially in the tiki world, that's top secret, you know?
I don't know why it's top secret. It's...
One of the other artists, I'm not going to say his name, but... I love him very much. He's a great guy, but he told me when he was getting into the mug making game that he said, man, he goes, it was like reinventing the wheel.
Yeah.
He's like, you know, like the processes and the technology and all that is out there and all the information and knowledge is just not being shared because maybe they feel threatened that there's a new player in town. I don't know.
I get that. But... I don't know, does anybody really have the patience to do it? It's just, you know, people need to have the patience to do it. And I don't know if people really do.
Oh, okay. But, you know, like you said, you don't know why it's a secret.
Yeah.
I don't either.
At my studio, if somebody wants to know stuff, I tell them.
Yeah.
I even show them how to do it.
Yeah. And I mean, the information is there for, I mean, if you go to an art class or you talk to somebody that's not a tiki mug maker,
right?
They'll share all the information with you. But in the tiki world, it's such a secret. And it is a bit of a pet peeve of mine, all the secretive stuff that happens, you know, like if there's a new bar that's opening, sometimes it's a secret that like, oh, don't tell anybody that this bar is opening. And it makes me wonder, like, okay, why? Is it to stroke your ego? Because really, it would be better to get people excited about it ahead of time so that when it opens, everybody's going to be there. Everybody wants to, you know. But then, you know, you're not building anticipation by keeping it a secret. You just want to get the oohs and the ahs when you finally say, oh, I'm opening a new bar, or here's a new mug, or whatever. You just want to get the oohs and ahs, and I think it's really an ego stroke a lot of times, you know? So it's a little bit annoying to me, but...
Well, you know, and there are some artists, ceramic artists out there that do stuff that I don't know how they do it. I don't care how they do it, because I'm not going to do it.
Right.
But it's a really interesting style. Or, you know, they do it at a different temperature that I can't do it at.
Okay, yeah. So, well, anyway, thank you for sharing your process. I'm sure that there's people that want to know some of this information, and there's probably some that are happy to now have that information. You know, pottery's been made for thousands of years.
Right.
We shouldn't have to try to relearn it every time we want to make a new project.
Exactly.
Right, so...
You know, a great example was I was just watching some pottery videos on YouTube, and then I came across a video that was how to do swirl pottery. And this was something I had never seen before. And it's basically just like marbling,
mm-hmm.
Where, you know, where I would put the colored clays together, and then it would, when I throw it, it'll just marble together. But this one was, you actually center the dark clay, and then you put some grooves around the outside, and then you put strips of a lighter color clay in it, and then when you pull it up, it'll look like how like a barber pole looks.
Okay.
With like solid stripes going around and twisting around.
Okay.
And I had never heard of anything like that until I saw it on YouTube, and it was, it really kind of changed, you know, how I do some of my props and pieces.
Cool. So I look forward to seeing a piece made that way now.
I have pieces made that way.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so, I've been making them, yeah.
Oh, maybe I haven't seen it then. Maybe I'm not familiar.
It's a difficult process because I use, like I said, the like a porcelain, which is a more dense clay, so it does kind of tend to break more.
Okay. Okay.
So I don't have a lot of those, but I do make them.
Yeah. Awesome. Well, it's about time that we start heading over to Tiki Tea.
Yeah.
What do you think?
Let's go get a drink.
Let's go get another drink. And for our listeners out there, if you have any questions, comments, or just want to leave a shout out, check out our group page on Facebook, Inside the Desert Oasis Room, or hit up Johnny Velour if you have any questions or you want to check out his work. Check him out, Johnny Velour with an IE.
I'll tell you all the secrets.
He'll tell you all the secrets. Cheers and aloha.
It's the nine, gate the nine, of the frozen that the line, don't know who's getting good, I'll let his food.